Hello and welcome to Top of the Progs on Smile Radio and also broadcasting on and in association with Progzilla Radio. You're currently listening to Easter by Marillion. I hope you enjoy it.
Side of the hill,
As we've had the Easter weekend, why not open Top of the Progs with Easter by Meridian, a classic track from the band's first album with Steve Hogarth, Seasons End, from 1989. Anyway, hello and welcome to Top of the Progs on Smile Radio, and also in association with and broadcasting on Progzilla Radio. So this week I thought, you know, let's just have some fun. Let's obviously open with Easter for the Easter weekend, and as we always do, there will be deep nuggets of weird facts about obscure prog rock tracks. Easter's a really interesting song. It was the first kind of Meridian song I think I actually loved, because I used to play it in the prog rock covers band I used to be in called Harmony of Spheres, with, funnily enough, none other than prog celebrity Charlie Bramell, the lead vocalist from Ghost of the Machine. He used to sing lead vocals in that band, and remember many a nights getting drunk people to sing along to Easter in various boozers in and around Sheffield, and it was always great fun. I really, really loved that track. Next up, we got a little bit of Genesis with a song from possibly the band's most unpopular album. Yes, that's right, we're talking about 1981's Abacab album. Now, the band describe Abacab, like, when some projects, it's more interesting to discuss the project than it is to actually listen to the album. I feel like that's the case with a lot of experimental and avant-garde music, that the concept behind the music is actually better than the music itself, and that could certainly be levelled at Abacab, as basically at this point Genesis had their own studio, and they decided, Tony Banks describes, that they were shedding the furniture of Genesis on the Abacab album. They were pretty much ripping up the rule book. They weren't really bringing any finished songs to the sessions. They were just jamming everything. They'd not really written anything at this point, and they were just trying to distance themselves from what they'd done before. For example, although Duke was a massive album and many see it as their best album, they kind of saw it as just doing the Genesis thing. You know, there's long songs, there's odd time signatures, you know, they've got the mystical lyrics and all the things like that, and they were trying to distance themselves from that. They were trying to invent a new sound, and they were saying that without Abacab, the 80s Genesis would not exist, because it allowed them to move forward. Even though it's probably their worst album, it allowed them to move forward and hit it out of the park with the next two albums, with Genesis by Genesis and Invisible Touch. But there's some great stuff on Abacab, I believe, and this is one of my favourite tracks. The Abacab album's got a very unfinished element about it. It's almost like they rocked up, turned everything up to 10, and just kind of went for it. And the first takes and first run-throughs are what you hear on the final album. It has that kind of not very well thought out, kind of almost improvised feel to it, which is very odd for Genesis, which is very well written and rehearsed. But this is a great piece from side two of the album. This is Dodo/Lurker by Genesis.
Where does he go? What does he do?
Phil Collins' Tubular Bell, which he'd not used since the end passage of Supper's Ready back in 1972, gets a good outing at the end of that track. But no, I really enjoyed that. It does have that kind of the grimy, unfinished, unpolished kind of element about it, but that's kind of what makes it good. It kind of what makes it unique. It was the band's first album with the longtime producer and collaborator Hugh Padgham, who would be with the band up until the end of the Invisible Touch album. And he brings to the table the sound, you know, the Phil Collins drum sound, the sound of the drums that we now associate with Phil Collins and Genesis, which basically they'd worked. Basically, Phil Collins met Hugh Padgham the day that he recorded the drums for Intruder by Peter Gabriel at the Townhouse Studio, where Hugh and Peter accidentally invented the gated reverb sound along with Phil Collins. And yeah, it's one of those really interesting ones because Phil basically brought him on to produce his next album, Face Value, because he wanted the same drum sound which he used on In the Air Tonight then. Phil Collins brought him into the fold in Genesis once they got the farm because he wanted that same massive drum sound for the Genesis albums. And I think Abacab does kind of work because it's very bare, very stripped back, but the drum sound kind of fills out the sound in Abacab. That massive pow, popping snare and the giant kick basically rounds out the sound really nicely. So this next song is a really interesting one, funnily enough, by Paul McCartney, who I don't think I've played any of his solo stuff on Top of the Progs before, so this is a first. Now, most people, like, you know, my parents' generation, people who are in the 50s, they grew up knowing Paul McCartney, not for the Beatles, but for his solo work. You know, people who were teenagers in the late 70s and early 80s, their kind of reference points when it came to Paul McCartney, John Lennon and George Harrison was not the Beatles back catalogue, but was their solo material. And I was having a conversation with my dad and I was like, what do you think Paul McCartney's best solo track is? And he said one which I'd never heard of before. Now, granted, I'm not intimately familiar with Paul's discography. I asked my mum as well, she said The Pipes of Peace, which is also a good track, but my dad said one which I'd never heard before, and he said, oh, put it on, so we searched it on YouTube on the telly, and we watched the video for it, and it's such a unique composition that I think it makes it really special. Like, my favourite Beatles songs are the ones which are essentially Paul McCartney solo tracks, for example, tracks like Blackbird and things like that. So this one kind of reminded me of that in that it's Paul just doing his own thing. It doesn't really have a genre, it doesn't really have a style. It leans into folk a little bit, this song, but it's from his second solo album after he'd done all the Wings stuff, McCartney 2. It's just a brilliant track. This is Waterfalls by Paul McCartney.
Waterfalls, please keep to the lake. People who jump waterfalls sometimes can make mistakes, and I need love. Yeah. Second needs an hour, like a raindrop needs a shower. Yeah, I need love every minute of the day, and it wouldn't be the same if you ever should decide to go away. Might wanna take you home. it wouldn't be the same if you ever should decide to go away. Don't go jumping waterfalls. Please keep to the
It's a really interesting track, that. There's a lot of weird noises in there. It's basically Paul McCartney's playing a Fender Rhodes electric piano, I believe, and he's also overdubbed some Prophet 5 synthesizer and a nice little bit of acoustic guitar scattered throughout. He's described that song as basically being about being old, basically. Like he said, at that point in his life, he wasn't really interested in writing songs about love affairs and teenage crushes and all that, like he was in the Beatles kind of early days. He was kind of, he turned 30 at this point, Ed McCartney, and he said he'd done a lot of thinking about his life and, you know, don't go jumping waterfalls. He basically says, and then him saying, I need love, is basically him saying to the people he loves in his life, don't do anything stupid. You know, keep, you know, because I need you basically in my life. Don't do anything stupid, don't get yourself hurt because I need you in my life. And I think that's it's a great message, which is disguised with some obtuse lyrics, and it's a really, really great track. Now I'm going to play one of the bands, funnily enough, that the Beatles had a massive rivalry with in the 1960s. The band, of course, is America's Beatles. I guess you could kind of argue it that way, the Beach Boys. So basically, the way it worked back in the 60s was the Beach Boys would put out an album, then the Beatles would hear it and think, we need to top that, and then they would put out an album, then the Beach Boys would hear the Beatles album and think, we need to top that, then they would put out an album, and the cycle endlessly repeated until basically Rubber Soul came out, basically, and that was kind of the one that kind of changed it all for Brian Wilson. He heard that and he thought, yo, I need to better this. I basically need to make the next Rubber Soul, the next big, big, big album. And he made Pet Sounds, which the Beatles, funnily enough, then heard and thought, we need to up our game. And then one-upped him once and for all with Sgt. Pepper. Could Brian Wilson have one-upped the Beatles again with the follow-up album Smile, which he never quite finished? Maybe if he'd been in a better mental state and he was able to finish it and he got the support he needed, maybe he could do that, but I'm not sure. But there's some amazing tracks on there. Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys. It's an album that's been endlessly dissected. It's nearly 60 years old. It's going to be 60 in 2026, I believe. So approaching its 60th anniversary, it's a classic album that stood the test of time. It's very unique. It's got its own sound. So this is one of my favourite songs off it. This is God Only Knows by the Beach Boys.
Always love you, but long as there are stars above you, you never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you. If you should ever leave me, well, life would still go on, believe me. The world could show nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you. I'd be without
the arrangement is so sparse and so kind of interesting on God Only Knows. There's very little what we call drums in that. It's played by Hal Blaine. There's kind of little snare rolls that kind of go on throughout the track. It's just such an interesting composition. I would say a great way to get more insight into the life of Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys and Pet Sounds. Funnily enough, if you're interested, there was a great biopic film that came out in 2014, I believe, titled Love and Mercy, and it was about the life of Brian Wilson. Now, of course, one of the main issues with music biopics is that they kind of glamorize the kind of subject matter, and they kind of make them this kind of godlike being. And I feel like another massive problem with all those movies is that they span like a really long space of time. Obviously, like, for example, Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, they start that film in like 1967 or 68, 69, and they end the film in 1985 with the Live Aid segment. So obviously that's like a 16-17 year span, basically, that they're kind of going on with in that film. And, of course, they're using the same actors throughout, so you kind of have to believe that they've aged 15 years, even though they're kind of the same actors who were the same age when they started shooting the film, basically. But one of the great things about Love and Mercy is it focuses on two very distinct points in Brian Wilson's life. It focuses on the 60s era with the Beach Boys, then the 80s era when he was under the control of the psychotherapist Eugene Landy and all that kind of weird stuff happened to him, basically. But the great saving grace of it is they get two different actors to portray the different Brians throughout his life. They get one actor to portray him during the Beach Boys, Pet Sounds era, and then they get an older actor to portray the kind of drug years of Brian Wilson of the 1980s. But it's a fascinating film, and there's a lengthy chunk, maybe like 15 to 20 minutes, devoted to the Pet Sounds era and how that album was made, and it really is a fascinating watch. There's also a great video on YouTube. It's from a documentary from the 1990s that Sir George Martin made about pop music. And there's a bit in it where George Martin talks about the American influence on the Beatles, and he says, as far as I'm concerned, no one matched the writing style and lyrics of one Brian Wilson. So he goes over to visit Brian in his home in Los Angeles in California, and he goes into Brian's studio, and Brian digs out the original 8-track multitrack of God Only Knows and shows it to George Martin. And then George Martin just like remixes it on the fly, like in the studio, and then Brian Wilson goes, wow, this sounds better than the mix that I did that ended up on the album, and it's a really nice moment. Anyway, we're going to have some serious prog rock now, with a couple of tracks from UK's 1979 live album Night After Night. So basically, it was the law if you were a band in the 70s that you had to go to Japan, and part of that law was that you had to release a live album recorded in Japan, and UK were no exception. This is the three-piece UK, so John Wetton on bass and vocals, Eddie Jobson on keyboards and violin, and one Terry Bozzio on drums. Terry Bozzio gets a drum solo at the start of this song. He absolutely plays his backside off on this whole live album. The drumming on this album is possibly some of the greatest recorded, I think, in prog rock. The technical skills, the flair, the emotion, and the energy that he has on these tracks is just amazing. Anyway, this is The Only Thing She Needs by UK, live in Japan in 1979. Thank you.
she sings a different tune. Don't turn up the blue. Now the sky is clearing, looking through her crystal eyes. Wake widows bloom before her, cutting her back down to size. Think she's searching for it, the only thing she needs. Yeah. Oh, 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 she needs.
have loved to have been at that concert and to seen that in action. The UK reunited in 2012 and again very briefly in 2015, and they did some tours in America and they went back to Japan. Funnily enough, not with Terry Bozzio in Japan, but with Marco Miniman on drums instead, which I guess was it was a great shame, I guess. It was a great shame because it would have been amazing to have those same three guys back in that same hall where they recorded the other one, basically just going absolutely wild all over again. But on the live videos from 2012, none of them are captured particularly well. It's just like mobile phone footage that we seem to basically have of that kind of era. And there's some great clips of Terry Bozzio shredding The Only Thing She Needs in tiny clubs, like basically blowing the heads off everybody in the audience with his giant drum kit and his monster cymbals. I just absolutely love it. This next cut's from the same live album, and interestingly enough, it's a reinterpretation of a piece from the first UK album. They really rock this one up and make it really kind of heavy and fast and kind of a bit of a thumper, whereas the original was kind of very subdued in kind of a lot of areas, very kind of more mellow. This one's kind of really in your face. This is 30 Years Live by UK.
Chasing rainbows for a lifetime of time to go, like shadows from the sun. Run into traces of faces you thought you saw, but never seemed to mean much more than echoes of a day gone by. Someone else would have to try to light the stars in your sky. Things you planned just sandcastles washed away on tidal waves of tears. The fears of a barren, the complex dreams just slither down and down in rocky pools, or smashed and dashed on barrel's course, forcing prematurely but a lasting love in your
What's great about that is just the power they're able to put. Like, the bootlegs of the original UK stuff isn't of the original lineup doing live, isn't really that good, unfortunately. I don't know. I feel like it's because of the way the music was just pieced together in the studio and then taken out on the road. They didn't really get the time to inhabit and feel the songs like they did at that point. Anyway, next up we've got a couple of David Bowie cuts from an album which, funnily enough, is turning 50 this year, his 1973 covers album, Pinups. This first one is David Bowie's reinterpretation of the Pink Floyd classic See Emily Play that he manages to David Bowie-ize in such an interesting way. It becomes his own song, and it's really fun. This is See Emily Play by David Bowie.
She's often inclined to borrow somebody's dreams till tomorrow.
Let's start walking, darling. Let's start
The next cut from his Pinups album I'm going to play is a song that was covered so well and done so good that everybody just assumed it was a David Bowie song. It's on all the greatest hits. It was Bowie's first ever number one hit in Australia, which is kind of quite strange, I guess. But it's one of those really interesting tracks that, yeah, for the longest time until I got the Pinups album, I had no idea this was a cover song, originally by a band called The McCoys, which was just a B-side. So it was, I guess it was easy pickings, I guess, if you just picked a random B-side and re-recorded it. But he's done it so well that everyone has always just assumed it's his own track. This is Sorrow by David Bowie.
Too long blonde hair and your eyes are blue. The only thing I ever got from you was sorrow. Sorrow. You're acting funny, trying to spend my money. You're out there playing your high-class games of sorrow. Sorrow. You never do what you know you ought to. Something tells me you're the devil's daughter. Sorrow.
So great that nobody had any idea it was ever a cover song. It's so genius, the arrangement on that, like the strings in the second verse really drive it along. I just absolutely love it. Now I'm going to end the show with a little tribute to Ian Benson, who sadly passed away at the end of last week on April the 7th, aged 69 years old, I believe. He was a Scottish session guitarist. He's one of those guys, you've heard his track, you don't know his name, but you have definitely heard his tracks. He was the longtime guitarist for the Alan Parsons Project, crafting the band's best known guitar parts and solos. And there was a great write-up Alan Parsons did about him, saying that he was the one that convinced Alan that Eye in the Sky was going to be a hit. Alan hated it, he didn't like it, he didn't want to use it, but Ian said, no Alan, we've got to pursue this is a hit. And Ian's guitars really drive the song, especially his acoustic guitar work on the track is absolutely magic. So I'm going to close the show now with a little bit of Eye in the Sky. Thank you all for listening, I hope you have a good week, goodbye.